And thank you to all of you who are here. This is a really great group, so I'm excited. And I will just preface all of this by saying that part of the reason I'm here at Holden is because I'm working on a larger project on this topic. So I'm hoping to write a book, mainly for a lay audience, to address some issues with the sex abuse crises that are being revealed in churches, especially in the United States. So part of what occurs to me as a biblical scholar from being in class is that the language that is being used in the New Testament to talk about community, to talk about authority, and to talk about the role of the layperson in community, brings with it a lot of baggage. And some of that baggage is intended by the authors in the first century, right? When they're talking about being a slave, being a soldier, being a child, they mean one thing. When we read those terms today, slave, child, soldier, athlete, we bring a whole lot of other baggage with us. And so I think it's worth sort of teasing out what was intended by the original authors and what their cultural context meant with those metaphors, and what we mean today and how those two things might be in agreement or disagreement. I think it's worth talking through those things. So I am very excited to hear from you as we work with these metaphors. What do they mean to you? And if you think about yourself as a member of Christian community, being a soldier of Christ, or today a slave of Christ Jesus, what associations come up for you? So to show you the plan, every day this week I'm going to play with one of these metaphors with you guys. We're going to explore these together. But the plan of the session is going to be basically this format. Looking at the first century context. So I'll start out with some background information to let you know what social reality was during the time when these New Testament texts were written. I've got some images. I have a little bit of historical information to share. And we're going to think through how these metaphors could create a sense of kinship and belonging. Then we're going to jump into our context, and here's where I really want feedback from you. I'm going to share a couple of case studies to say, hey, when I think slave today, here are some of the things that come to mind. But I would like to hear from you about additional case studies, whether these ones make sense to you, whether we should be adding something else to the discussion. And then the final piece of the conversation each day will be about if we decide to keep this metaphor as a way of describing who we are as people in the church, what are the perils associated with that, and does it still hold promise for us? Is it still meaningful and useful for thinking about who we are together? So that's the basic plan. I want to start with a text. So we're looking at the letter to Philemon. This is one of the only letters in the New Testament that's written to an individual. And this is probably by Paul, writing to Philemon and to Philemon's household. He expected that the letter would be read aloud. So there's a little bit of a shame game going on here as Paul instructs Philemon to welcome his runaway slave Onesimus back into the household without any kind of penalty. So I'll go ahead and read this aloud. If you have a Bible in front of you, you can read along, and your translation may be different. I am appealing to you, Philemon, for my child, Onesimus, whose father I have become during my imprisonment. Formerly he was useless to you, but now he is indeed useful, both to you and to me. I am sending him, that is, my own heart, back to you. I wanted to keep him with me so that he might be of service to me in your place during my imprisonment for the gospel. But I prefer to do nothing without your consent in order that your good deed might be voluntary and not something forced. So like I said, there's a little bit of shame here, a power play that Paul is picking up on. Perhaps this is the reason he was separated from you for a while, so that you might have him back forever. No longer as a slave, but more than a slave, a beloved brother. Especially to me, but how much more to you? Both in the flesh and in the Lord. So if you consider me your partner, welcome him as you would welcome me. If he's wronged you in any way or owes you anything, charge that to my account. So just looking at this passage initially, I think we get some insight into what it meant to be a slave in the first century and what it meant to be a slave in a household that had converted to believing that Jesus was the Christ. Okay. So any initial thoughts that you have about what this conveys about being a slave in Paul's time?
I'm curious if there's any historical record. Did he accept him back with, you know, with graciousness and not, you know, in slavery?
We don't have any record of what happened in this household after this letter. This is what's preserved. I would guess that the fact that the letter got preserved, Philemon might not have allowed it to be saved if he did not follow the directions. So my guess is that it might have played out the way Paul wanted.
Otherwise,
yes. I'm going to get rid of that one. Yes, please.
I'm impressed that Onesimus had no say in what his future was going to be. Things were being decided for him. His opinion about what might be his choice is not considered.
Absolutely. This is a reality of slave life in the first century. He doesn't have the authority. He has run away from the household. He's gone to Paul, so he's clearly got some sense of who has power in the community, and he's going to align himself with the person who can protect him. But he doesn't get to make the choice for himself. He comes back to the household with a letter of recommendation and with some strong words on the part of Paul, but he does not get to decide his own fate. And it seems to me like there's even some potential danger to him, right? If Philemon did not welcome him back as a beloved brother, this context suggests to me that there might have been punishment in store, right? If he's wronged you in any way or if he owes you anything, Paul makes sure to say, charge that to my account, right? Don't take it out on Onesimus himself. Suggest that that would have been the natural course of action, right? Philemon would have punished Onesimus for running away if Paul didn't instruct him not to.
Couldn't that be interpreted as a reference for employment?
The letter?
Well, like a good reference for employment.
Yeah, where do you see that this is a letter of reference?
Well, slave, a white slave. I don't know, I just went daft into my head.
Sure, I think there's definitely reference here, right? He's trying to say he was useless to you, but now he's really useful. And that's a play on Onesimus's name. That name in the Greek has to do with usefulness. So Paul is sort of doing a word play here, but it is a letter of recommendation, right? Take him back. He's good for the gospel. Yeah.
Well, aren't they, like this passage here, all of them are brothers in Christ. Like Onesimus, Paul, and Philemon, they're all believers, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So there is this switch, right? And that says to me, being a slave was not a good position. Because what Paul is saying is bring him back, but not as a slave. Bring him back as a brother. Yeah, please, in the blue shirt.
He has to go back, though.
Yes.
And there's sort of an implication there that running away was the wrong thing to do, and now you have to go back, and Paul has talked him into it, mm-hmm. or something. And so now he's going back into the situation that he found intolerable before.
Yes. And we don't know why Onesimus left. But it does suggest that something was going on in that household where he was not happy, right? And we don't know too much about what he wants, but he is getting sent back not in his former status, but as a beloved brother. So there's expected that there will be some kind of change in his treatment. But we're not sure what that means either.
The appeal came to me was, even though the three of them are believers in Christ, the social class still seems to be separated from that in terms of slave and owner.
Right. This letter very much reflects an existing social reality that Paul may or may not be trying to change. And we are going to look at a couple of other passages where the term slave comes up. And it's a real question whether Paul wants to overturn the status quo in Greco-Roman society of his time. Spoiler alert, I don't think that he does, because he's got this strong expectation that Jesus is coming back, and Jesus is coming back really soon, so don't mess with the way of life. Just adhere to this new teaching, believe that Jesus is the Christ, have faith, and when he comes back, everything's going to change anyway, so just leave the system the way it is. But in your own household, maybe you treat your slaves slightly differently. I'm going to take one more comment.
it occurs to me that Onesimus is like just trying to figure out something, and now he's like got himself entangled with Paul and all this Jesus stuff that he may or may not believe in, and he's just trying to like play his cards a little bit.
Yes.
Like, I'm really trapped, and now he's trapped the other way, if you ask me. He's like, now he's got to do, he's also a slave to Paul.
Right, because we have Paul's voice, we've got this one-way communication between Paul and Philemon and anyone who's listening in on the letter. But we don't know what Onesimus thinks. We maybe can piece together that he knew that Paul could help him, but at what cost, right? One more.
I had a question about the use of the word, no one's mentioned this, the use of the word child in the first
yes.
line. Mm. And so it seems to infer that there's some kind of paternalistic relationship between like a master and a slave.
Or, mm-hmm.
And is there anything you could say about that?
One of the words in Greek, so we've got this, my child, Onesimus, a word in Greek that might be used, and I didn't bring my Greek New Testament with me, I should bring it every other day, pais, could be used, it means child, but it can also mean slave. So this is a translator's choice to say my child, Onesimus, to translate it that way.
But is there any, like, analogies between, you know, like, is there some kind of paternalistic relationship between master and slave, or is that just a coincidence?
No, there absolutely is. And so it might be in some ways akin to the American parallel in slavery of calling a man boy, right? To call somebody pais conveys that relationship of superiority and inferiority, the power differential. So that's a really nice transition into some of the things I want to share about slavery in the ancient world and in a particularly Roman imperial context. So I brought some images, and this is an image of slaves. This is a mosaic from the 2nd century CE, and you can see slaves here serving wine or water. We've got two different jugs, and this is really the image that we might have in our head of slaves, right? They're in this society there to serve the needs, including the bodily needs of their owners. But this image also shows something that I think we need to keep in mind from our contemporary American context. Slavery in the ancient world was not good. I'm not trying to say it was a positive condition at all, but it was not quite the same as American chattel slavery. So when we picture slavery as it happened in the United States, not the same thing. It wasn't based on race. People could become enslaved in the ancient world in a number of different ways, often through war. If your territory was defeated, you could be taken into slavery. Sometimes slavery was more like indentured servitude, that you got into debt. And in order to work off your debt, you became enslaved. But often you would not be able to physically tell the difference between a slave and a free person based on physical appearance, right? It would be more about clothing. It would be about jewelry. It would be about displays of wealth. But there was nothing, it was not based on race or appearance in the same way that slavery came to be in the New World. That is not to say that slavery was an ideal condition for anyone. Yeah, question.
I'm curious, the slaves look much larger
yes.
than the rest of the people.
Yeah, I think that's probably a way to show that they are in the foreground and that they are the focal point of this mural. So somehow this mural is designed to be showing the slaves as what's important in the picture. I don't know enough about the context of the mural to be able to explain why that might be true.
Yeah.
Slaves were very closely integrated into the household, and this is an interesting depiction of what would have been on a Greek vase. What's shown here is, from left to right, a teacher holding a text with the young student, and then a figure called the pedagogue or the paidagogos. And that is related to that word pais that I talked about. It means child, and then agoge has to do with leading. So there was a specific role in Greek society of a paidagogos, a child leader. Now, generally, that was a slave in the household who was responsible for the raising of the children and for their education and their moral formation in a lot of ways. So this is, again, a difference between slavery as we might think about it in our American context and slavery in the ancient world. A lot of slaves were educated people, were fully integrated into the household and trusted with the care and raising of children.
It's like nannies today.
It can be like nannies, yes. They were not paid, and they were not free to make their own choices, but they were educated. And it would often be an educated person who was brought in and made a slave because of the promise that they held for raising children. This gets back to the question of authority structures within a Greek or a Roman household. Specifically in the empire, the man of the house, the father, was known as the paterfamilias, the father of the family, and he had all kinds of authority over everyone within that household. You could put it very starkly, he had the authority to choose life or death for members within the household, was usually responsible for all of the financial decisions, was the public face of that household community dealing with everybody in the city. And women were under that. Some women had authority. Women usually did not have financial freedom. Their household finances that they managed were all under the control of the paterfamilias. Children in the household had some authority, especially male children. Female children were, again, below that. And then underneath everybody else were slaves. And there are a lot of philosophical texts from the ancient world that talk about whether or not slaves are fully human. Right? That might sound like familiar language to us. Are they intellectual enough to have reason? Or do they fall in the category of animals who were thought not to have a rational mind? Right? This is in Aristotle. If you think that Aristotle is really great and talks about virtue, he says slaves can't have virtue. Their virtue is obedience. That's the sole the sole virtue that slaves can acquire. So we have this dichotomy, right? This image shows a trusted slave who is caring and bringing up the child, but their social status was not somebody who could make decisions for themselves or have control over anything, really. Sometimes slaves were trusted, though, and we do have some stories from the ancient world of a practice called manumission, which is the freeing of slaves, and there is a whole class in Roman society of freed persons. So of freed slaves who were able to then acquire property and wealth. And you can see, especially in funerary reliefs, there would be these carvings that were put over sarcophagi of bust portraits, and they would be labeled, and a lot of them are of freed persons. So we know that there was this whole group. Slaves could be freed if they had rendered a particularly special service to the household. A lot of times in the paterfamilias' will, after his death, he would manumit certain slaves of the household who had been especially faithful servants.
Would those slaves then stay with the household? Or would
sometimes they would stay with the household. Sometimes they would, because this was a larger family structure than what we think about today, it's not just a nuclear family. Mm-hmm. So sometimes slaves would stay in that area. Sometimes they would go off on their own to start their own households. Mm-hmm. Now, what I've said about paterfamilias, materfamilias, male children, female children, slaves, you can imagine that even with this group of slaves, male and female slaves were, there was a differential treatment of male and female slaves. So I have this image here, which actually became really famous a couple of years ago because people said, ah, they had laptops in the ancient world, right? Here is the slave holding her mistress's laptop. This is actually an image of a woman at her toilet, so she is preparing for the day, and this is probably a mirror and a cosmetic case. But you can imagine what you like. Ancient aliens are in our midst. But you can see here, even in the piece of art, this is an elite Roman woman with her female slave. It's unlikely that the slave is a child. This is probably a full-grown woman, but even in the art, the slave is being portrayed as smaller to represent that social distinction. And it was definitely a reality for both male and female slaves, but more for female slaves, that their bodies were at the disposal of their masters or mistresses. So that means they could be forced into sexual service against their will. That was not thought to be strange at all. And so their place in the household was even more precarious, right? Because they were physically able to be put to any use that their owners or their owners' friends wanted. So if we think about, again, that hierarchical structure, you've got Onesimus, and then even below Onesimus, any female slaves that might have been in Philemon's household who are not mentioned. Right? So then when we think about Christianity, and we think about Paul's letter to Philemon, when he says, welcome him back into your household, not as a slave, but as a beloved brother. And when he calls Philemon my child, when he calls Onesimus my child and says, he has been useful to me, welcome him back into your household, you can see that what Paul is suggesting is a real change of status for Onesimus if he goes back into that household, right? He may no longer be useful in the same way that he was before as a slave, but now he can be useful in the service of the gospel as a brother, as a child, as a more valued member of that household in terms of actual social status. So what I'd like us to look at together is another passage where Paul uses this imagery of slaves just to throw a wrench into things. In the letter to the Galatians, Paul has just in chapter 4 in Galatians gone into this allegory about Hagar and Sarah from the story of Abraham in Genesis, that Sarah is the free wife, and so her child is the free child, and Hagar is the slave wife, and her child is the slave child. And of course you want to be aligned with the free side and not with the slave side, right? Don't be a slave, be free. Then he says, for you were called to freedom, brothers and sisters. Only do not use your freedom as an opportunity for self-indulgence, but through love become slaves to one another. For the whole law is summed up in a single commandment, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. So now Paul is using slavery as a metaphor for what it means to be part of the Christian community. So we've seen with Philemon, he's trying to overturn slavery and say, once you're a Christian, you're no longer slaves, you're brothers. But now he says, okay, you're brothers. What that means is you should be slaves to one another. How does this work as a metaphor for belonging? Does that make sense, given the historical context? Yes.
In the first text, the word was child, it meant slave. Does this word slaves maybe mean child?
I think this one is probably doulos, which means slave or servant. If you have your translation, it probably says slave or servant there. So there are different words that could be used. And so I think pais usually gets translated as child by editors. Yeah.
Don't the menial tasks still have to be done?
Yes. So how would this play into that?
Well, somebody has to do it. So if we're all brothers, we have to do it for each other.
Okay. So no longer differentiate. People have different kinds of service. Everyone must serve in the community in a shared, common way. Okay.
So very often these households, there may have been more of the slaves than there would have been of the higher household. Mm-hmm. So the idea here of becoming slaves is really that idea of becoming one and maybe sharing, and that you're kind of going to, instead of moving everybody up, moving everyone into the majority.
Okay, and that's really interesting to me, right? The idea that if everyone becomes a slave, then nobody has the higher power status, right? Nobody's got control of the wealth. Everyone is a slave. And so we can all be unified down here. That's really interesting for thinking about what it means to be part of the community, right? Because then who has authority? Jacob, I see your hand too.
So one of the things that happens in moves to monotheism is the separation of the divine from human authority structures,
mm-hmm.
is that a similar thing to what we're talking about here then, where nobody is to have life and death power over another, no one's the paterfamilias, and so there we're in a sense, only God has that mm-hmm. higher role?
Right, you become slaves to one another because in this household, it's God or it's Jesus who is the head. And you're not slaves to him, right? This doesn't say become slaves of Christ Jesus right here. That shows up elsewhere, but here it says be slaves to one another.
Somebody has to do this duty.
So it's providing services, right? Caring for the physical needs of other people who are in your community. I saw your hand go up too.
Oh, I basically was going to say the same thing in that you become servants, slaves to Christ who has freed you so that you may serve.
Mm-hmm. Right? Freedom is not so that you can amass more power.
Right.
Freedom is so that you can join in service.
The last line in that paragraph is actually a warning that if you don't be a slave to one another and instead bite and devour each mm-hmm. other, beware, you could be devoured as well. So it's
yes.
he's trying to develop a sense of community
mm-hmm.
without the hierarchical structure so that they all sit and get in a circle and sing kumbaya.
Is that what it's asking for? I mean, I agree with you that it's saying get away from the power structure, right? The danger is if you start playing with swords, then you're going to get hit by the sword, right? This is straight out of the gospel message. But is this about singing kumbaya?
It's really interesting to me that he makes the law even simpler than Jesus does. Right? So Jesus says the whole law is summed up in a single commandment, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, your soul, and your veriness. And the second is like it, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. And Paul does away with the God stuff here.
Yeah. Yep. What kind of community is he imagining?
I also think it's interesting that he doesn't say your neighbor and yourself, but the commandment says as. So we're commanded to love ourselves.
Yes. That's implicit in there, right? You love your neighbor
yeah,
as yourself.
You can't do that.
And it's, I think that's an overturning of slavery, right? So this is where he's playing with that metaphor and pushing it to its limit, because slaves did not have bodily autonomy, right? If you think about their role in the household, mm-hmm. they can be used by anybody for anything. So to empower a slave to love your neighbor as yourself elevates the position of that slave to somebody who has a little bit more control, who has a little bit more self-reliance and love and care for self. Because slaves were not supposed to be doing that, right? Their priority was not themselves, but their masters. So he's taking that metaphor and he's twisting it a little bit, which I think is important for us to notice, that when he's using slave, he's taking his cultural context and he's already sort of pushing it to its outer limit. I saw another hand. Yeah.
The people who were in the structure, all of them were stuck. I mean, the slaves were in their area, but the people who had the power were also imprisoned by their place, that they couldn't move either.
Sure.
So I don't know what I'm saying, except it's not just the slaves who were stuck.
Mm-hmm.
It's the wives and the brothers, and everybody had to be where they were, or that was it. I mean, they couldn't love the slaves either. They couldn't.
Right, in this very sort of stratified society, I think you're right that there are social pressures on everyone at every level of that social ladder.
Freedom has to come to everybody, not just the slaves.
Right? And to be called to freedom mm-hmm. and to use it to serve one another.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to put another passage up here because this gets to the question of, was Paul actually trying to get rid of the slave structure of his time? Like I said, spoiler alert, no, I don't think so. I don't think he's ready to overturn Roman society and suggest a totally different model outside of the individual household. Now, 1 Timothy, complicated, because it's probably not Paul himself, right? Biblical scholars agree that this is probably something from a later generation, from an author who is claiming to be Paul, to sort of pick up on that Pauline authority. He was seen as an important writer and theologian and thinker in the early community, and so in the next generation, someone who wanted to convey a message and talk about something important and teach might have said, okay, I'm Paul, and I'm giving this message to you, Timothy. So we can talk more about that if you have questions. But 1 Timothy has a set of instructions for people in the household, right? Did Paul's message of everyone's going to be slaves to one another actually work? Did it change anything? No, because 1 Timothy may be written around 115 CE. Let all who are under the yoke of slavery regard their masters as worthy of all honor, so that the name of God and the teaching may not be blasphemed. Those who have believing masters must not be disrespectful to them on the ground that they are members of the church. Rather, they must serve them all the more, since those who benefit by their service are believers and beloved. So here I think we see, in the generations after Paul, a slight shift, right? Don't disrupt the status quo. Paul was saying that because he thought Jesus was coming back right away. By the time 1 Timothy is written, Jesus hasn't come back yet, right? So people are starting to freak out. Why isn't he here yet? We have to figure out how to live as a community in the world as it is. How do we structure ourselves? Well, we structure ourselves on the model of the Roman imperial household, where there are fathers and mothers and children, and there are defined roles for people in the household, and the role for slaves is to be faithful to their masters, to be obedient. It's not to be a slave to one another through love, to love others as yourself. It's to be a slave so that the outside world will look at us and see that our households are respectable, so that the Christian message won't be blasphemed or looked down on by the rest of society. And it's to serve because who you're serving is a master who is Christian. They're believers, they're beloved, so serving them is a righteous action.
So the slaves are still doing the dishes.
Yes, yes, they are. And every other horrible thing. Not that dishes are horrible. I don't like doing dishes, but that's not. Right, so, and this passage and others like it have been used throughout history in nefarious ways, or maybe in the ways that they were intended, to maintain social structures that benefited some at the expense of others. Right? So it's interesting to me that even when Paul pushes this metaphor to its limit to say, now slavery is about belonging, right? Slavery is about kinship and what we share in common. Very quickly, that metaphor gets used by its society in a more typical way, right? Or in a way that is useful to some groups at the expense of others. Yes?
If a slave is a Christian, that doesn't raise them up to the level that they should be served by.
That's what appears to be happening here, right? The slave is Christian, and so the good thing for a Christian slave to do is to be obedient to a Christian master. And you can see the reverberations of that throughout history. And so I want to bring us forward to the present day to think about some case studies that might inform our use of this term slave, and we can talk about whether we can rehabilitate it, whether we should abandon it entirely, right? Is it useful for us to talk about being slaves in the household of God? Or do we have too much baggage that we can't get rid of, or is the baggage of such a type that we can't work around it? So just some things to consider today. I wanted to talk about wage slavery, specifically prisoners who are being exploited. I have some statistics here that I'd like to share with you. 2.3 million people are incarcerated in government and private prisons in the United States. Half of those inmates work.
For a pittance or nothing.
Correct. Some prisoners in 8 states don't get paid at all in government-run facilities. And those states are Alabama, Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Mississippi, Oklahoma, South Carolina, and my new home state of Texas. The national average for inmates who do receive the least compensation for work is 14 cents per hour. The countrywide average for those receiving the most is 63 cents per hour. Inmates in Minnesota and New Jersey can receive the highest hourly rate for prison maintenance jobs, which is $2 per hour. So you can see that these are statistics from last year, August 2018.
They get room and board.
So this is an exploitative system, right? And so it's worth us thinking about, okay, so we've solved the problem of slavery in the United States, but it has reared its head in other forms, right? And I say solved the problem with scare quotes around that word, right? Because we might think about the legacy of slavery in the United States in race relations in our criminal justice system, right? This has not gone away, but this is a very visible way in which slavery is happening.
Do you have any sense on those numbers of whether or not the prisoners have any ability to choose that they want to work versus they'll opt out of it? Because I know some places I think they may choose to.
I think there are, as far as I know, there are restrictions on who is allowed to work. And of course, if you're being put in solitary confinement, if you have other restrictions on you, no, you're not allowed to work and earn wages during that time. But I don't know beyond that. That's a really interesting question. Yeah.
There are some competitive,
right.
Instead of 14 cents
right.
an hour, they might earn 75 cents. So. All prisons have an industry, and those jobs typically are the most desirable because they pay the most.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you are expected, unless you're in solitary, you are expected to clean toilets or whatever. For starters, yeah.
And these statistics come from government facilities, right? So that's not even talking about private prisons, and I did not bring statistics with me from privately owned facilities. Yeah.
Do the states that don't pay correlate at all with the states that were Confederate states?
The list was Alabama, Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Mississippi, Oklahoma, South Carolina, and Texas.
So they still haven't admitted they lost.
Right? So it's not unrelated to the history of slavery in the United States, right?
Well, and it's worth noting that the 13th Amendment that officially ends slavery has within it an exception for those who are committed of offenses, right? So the 13th Amendment explicitly is written in order to allow prison slavery.
And this is the slavery that's going on that is licit, that is legal in our country.
Isn't that a debt to society that they're paying back?
Yeah. Right, and there are lots of ways to think about this. So then we can go back to the question of, is this indentured servitude, right? While you're paying off your debt, you are allowed to be exploited in this way. Like, what are our standards, right? Where do we draw the line about the ethical treatment of other human beings, regardless of their behavior, right? That's a big question. Yeah.
Do you have any information on educational opportunities, becoming able to have a job when their time is served?
I haven't looked into this. It's a really great question, and how it's correlated to pay in some of these jobs, right? Realizing the averages ranging between 14 cents and 63 cents, right? So, okay, so you've got this educational opportunity that teaches you a trade, so now you can earn 55 cents instead of 17. What is compensation, right? Is education and training a form of compensation that we would recognize as being better in some way?
So that they could have a real job, so that they would not necessarily. I think some of those programs have ended. That they used to have programs in which you could learn a skill, so that you could have a job when you got out of person, right? I mean, that would be the ideal, that they could then become part of society again instead of being not allowed to have a job because they have been have a history of incarceration.
Right. That would be really interesting to look into. And like I said, I'm doing a larger project on this, so things that you are bringing up as things I should consider for the case studies, I really appreciate.
Yeah, because it's one of the things that's cut first.
Mm-hmm.
As the educational opportunity.
Right.
Especially anything beyond high school.
Right.
A GED.
Mm-hmm.
But even that.
Therapeutic opportunities in there.
Right. Thank you. Right, if we're thinking about, are we just taking advantage of people's labor, or is this somehow, can it be, is that right to think about labor that is also benefiting you in some sort of restorative justice type of way? And does intention matter, right? So even if the intention is to work on restorative justice and give people opportunities that will benefit them when they're not incarcerated, does that make this okay?
There's also a piece to this of how people end up in the prison system in the first place, right? So with the move towards mass incarceration, specifically of minority populations, then what we have is a reinstantiated race-based slavery.
Yes.
Right.
Right. But legal.
Right.
Right.
Well, slavery was legal.
It was also legal, but legal again, differently constituted. I saw your hand.
It seems hard to take just what they're paid out of context and when you... If you look at the whole picture, a friend of mine ran for office, I think it was 15 years ago, and the average cost in Washington State for one prisoner was $42,000 a year at that time. And so I can't imagine what it is today. But how does that all get taken into this?
You know? Right.
And somebody mentioned, yeah, they do get room and board and they get medical. And you know, so the overall cost, it's hard to relate it to a person who's supporting themselves in society.
Right, and to me, this comes back again to who is being arrested and for what, who's being incarcerated and for what, and are there opportunities in our society for restorative justice, or do we just have this system of incarceration, right? So are we directing, so there is a huge direction of funds towards this. Is this the best use of our funds?
Right? Can I just say that I'm having a hard time imagining that word. Talking about imprisonment as, well, they get room and board. I mean, it went from kind of funny, but, oh, yeah, well, they are getting room and board. And I think that's just weird. I mean, I think we should call that out and have a discussion about that because, like,
yeah,
I just
we need to, because there are people who go back on purpose.
Yeah.
They're hot some cot, and they have got it outside. They're living under a bridge.
It's a harder life out.
Yes, for some people it is. It's hard, and especially if they've been in before and they kind of know it. There are people who want to go back and deliberately offend to go back. And I know a couple of them.
I mean, and that becomes a bigger question for our society, right?
So
what kind of supports do we have?
You know,
right, it's not isolated.
To help people.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right, so can we, yeah, I'm not going to say anything else, yeah.
I'm wondering what is the difference between a prisoner, say, in a prison in Alabama and one who's in a minimum security prison because he's caught manipulating the stock market.
Right, white collar crime?
This kind of work? I don't think so.
No. Right. And that goes back to stratification of society that exists that gets reflected in the system, right? Yeah.
Yeah. I invite you to look at Florida.
Mm-hmm.
Florida, like, I don't remember exactly, but like one out of every four black males has been in prison, has gone through the system. And Florida said, we're going to let ex-felons vote, which sounds wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they can only vote if they've paid back every fine and charge that has come to them. If they've been charged for room and board, you know, and that's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a poll tax.
And that's speaking about what we mean broadly by slavery, right? If you're enslaved to a system that never allows you to escape, isn't that just as bad as well, not having your rights restored.
If you want to talk about escape, how about payday loans?
Mm-hmm.
With really high interest rates that you just cannot escape.
I think it very quickly, I think as our discussion is showing, it very quickly becomes an issue of larger ethics, but also of our entire economic system, right? Being implicated in the choices that we're making. I want to throw another case study up here just for a second. This is the one that might be easier for us to talk about, I guess, because we might not feel as complicit. But human trafficking, right? Specifically sex trafficking and trafficking of children. Let me see what I have here. Human trafficking is a $32 billion a year industry. 4.5 million trafficked persons are sexually exploited. Up to 300,000 Americans under 18 are lured into the commercial sex trade every year. And these are statistics from April 2019. So you can see a gender breakdown over there of the children who are most at risk for being trafficked. And what is going on with trafficking? The largest proportion of it is sex trafficking, but some of it is labor trafficking as well. And there are lots of documentaries on Netflix, actually, that show sort of the pipelines and the different highways that are major corridors for trafficking, especially in native populations. I have a friend who is a criminologist, and a lot of trafficking takes place through the casinos in that Texas-Oklahoma corridor, and people disappear. So this is another one I wanted to bring up for consideration as a modern thing we should be considering when we think about that image of slavery or the metaphor of slavery.
Thinking about people when they do sting at raids, who is the victim, right? And who is the who goes to jail?
Yeah, right.
Because the victims used to be put in jail, and I don't know if they, and sometimes still are.
So I just wanted to throw these ones out there. Are there other things that come to mind when we say slave today? Yes.
Well, the raids on the poultry companies in the South, sort of like, well, you know, you're not going to have any union problems because these people, in a sense, are slaves because we've accepted your false ID, the working here.
Sure. Undocumented workers.
Yeah. You better stay here at $5 an hour.
Right.
Well, not just in the South. Both Iowa and Minnesota have recently had examples of this.
Right.
And who pays the price? The owner of the company?
No, right.
They're not the ones that are...
Yeah, I think in the recent case, there were no arrests for the people who committed the felony, but for the people who were working without documentation, which is a misdemeanor, those people were arrested and taken away. Yeah. Yes, please.
This just came to me and I haven't thought it through, but is there a portion of the U.S. military that imposes that?
Imposes what?
A sense of slavery, even if it's voluntary, to these young people who have no other choices than they go in and it's...
That's a tricky one, right? I'm going to say I agree with you, and people might get mad at me. I don't know, but I lived in Chicago, and there were parades every year that were all the young people in the high schools who were junior ROTC, and it was overwhelmingly people of color who may not have had other economic opportunities for advancement, and so the military was their way. And I'm not trying to malign anybody's sense of duty to the country or pride in our military, but... that was a very stark sort of picture of these children marching down the street.
A portion of it,
Well, those doors that otherwise wouldn't have been open.
That's right. But for people who may feel like that is their only choice.
At what price?
Yeah.
Well, in a situation where stop loss is now the law. Stop loss, so you can sign up for a single term and then be forcibly returned to the military after that.
Oh.
The military needs more people.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. I appreciate it.
But there's also the sense that in Vietnam, we were more concerned because there was a chance we'd get drafted and sent there, where now it's just a hired, it's our hired slave class that fights the wars.
And that are somewhat invisible in a lot of ways, right? We don't, there's military action that has been going on for years that is not being talked about, right?
And worse, when they come back with disabilities, mental or physical, mm-hmm. the underfunding of the VA, they just, oh, good luck, and right. don't blow your brains out, or go ahead.
Right, and specifically on the issue of soldiers, we're going to talk more about soldiers and especially the experience of military vets later this week. I forget what day. There's a day on soldiers. So I'm really excited to talk with you about your thoughts for that. So I want to be mindful of our time. We have about 8 minutes, and so I want to turn to our final discussion with a passage that I think is going to be part of our Vespers this evening. So is this metaphor useful for us? And I wanted to throw out one of the more complicated passages where slavery is used in Paul's letters. In this hymn that he may not have written, it may be before Paul's time, but he picks it up and it's in the letter to the Philippians. Let the same mind be in you that was in Christ Jesus, who though he was in the form of God, did not regard equality with God as something to be exploited, but emptied himself, taking the form of a slave, being born in human likeness. And being found in human form, he humbled himself and became obedient. Remember that obedience was the hallmark of a slave's virtue, to the point of death, even death on a cross. Therefore, God also highly exalted him and gave him the name that is above every name, so that at the name of Jesus, every knee should bend in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue should confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. The title that is the opposite of slave, right? To the glory of God the Father. Is the metaphor of slaves of Christ Jesus useful, helpful, promising, positive for church today? Is it purely problematic? What are some of the problems with it? When we look at a passage like this, what do we do with that call to be slaves to one another?
Yeah. I would, first strikes me as a sort of how radical this notion is.
Sure.
And so in that regard, you know, it carries some weight in what a radical shift we're considering here.
And if we think in Paul's own time, right, to say that Jesus Christ emptied himself, he's equality with God. He was in the form of God, and then he becomes a slave, right? And then he gets exalted and gets all power. that is incredibly radical. I'm going to call you and then Jacob.
But he can go where he wants to go, talk to who he wants to talk to. And so on. I mean, the slave part of it is kind of.
It's being pushed to its limit, right? Because there is a choice here,
yeah.
right? That slaves did not have, right?
Mm-hmm. So I think he's also playing with the death on a cross here, because Paul could not be killed on a cross. Right, Paul had to be killed by beheading because he was a Roman citizen.
Mm-hmm.
But Jesus is killed as a slave.
Mm-hmm.
So in this hymn, then, we have Jesus being killed in this way that is reserved only for slaves and foreigners.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I think I've been a review who used this text doing some spiritual discernment.
Okay.
And the wonderful thing about it is that it brings everyone, it humbles all of us as well. Because then, in our society, which has become so polarized, it is really helpful to be reminded that Christ humbled himself. And when we have discussion, if we can just have that as an overlay, it takes a lot of the self-righteousness out of the conversation. And it really has it has been helpful in letting people be a little bit more open to others.
And the question for me, as soon as you say self-righteousness, right, I'm thinking, okay, this is on a spiritual level, right? Are we all humbling ourselves spiritually, or does it go beyond that?
Well, in our experience, it has gone beyond that. Uh-huh. People are so set on this way and so set on that way, it brings some common ground.
Sure. So it's the image of slavery that brings with it in our contemporary day that idea of loneliness, right? Of humility.
Right. But I think servant, I'm guessing that's a dual.
Yes. Right? Yeah.
And so whether you call it slave or servant in that context, I don't know if it would matter.
Okay. Interesting, because I think we're more comfortable with thinking about humility as a positive term associated with servants than slaves. Because yeah. Humiliation, right, is not something that most of us are comfortable with.
Right.
But humility.
Right. And servants, serving is more acceptable than slavery.
Yes. Yes.
Because slavery, suggests that there is a master.
Right.
Whereas servants, one can be servants to one another in a egalitarian way.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so I think... there's a lot there that we carefully parse in order to use the term. We're like, we mean it like this and not like that. but that's really interesting that we are doing that work because we have a cultural understanding of what slavery means and that it is very bad. So we need to mm-hmm. carefully navigate how we use that term. Yeah.
Doesn't the context of Philippi add to this meaning because it was in the outermost parts of the Roman Empire,
mm-hmm.
and the disenfranchised soldiers were sent there, often against their will.
It was a military colony, yes.
And it was right on the edge. They would have to, invaders, they would be the first area. So a lot of it was against their will, so that Christ became a slave, not unlike them, would add to the meaning as they read these particular verses.
So then the cultural context might be, where do we identify ourselves, right? So does this metaphor of slavery work better for us if we see ourselves as disempowered, right? Because then Christ is becoming like us and we can all be equal. What if we see ourselves as the ones who are empowered, right? Then the idea of humiliating yourself or being humble might be more of a challenge to us. So from our social position, where do we identify with the metaphor? And where would the first century readers have identified? That's very helpful.
I think line 7 is pretty key. He talks about emptying himself.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to be the process that comes before the ability to humble himself.
Yes.
So what does that mean, to empty yourself?
Yes. And the term that we use is from the Greek kenosis, which is that emptying. And I think we're going to hear more about that tonight. I want to be mindful of our time because it is now 10 o'clock. But I hope you will all come back. And if you have ideas throughout the day or throughout the week of things we should be thinking about as we think with that metaphor of slavery, I would really welcome your contributions. I'd really appreciate hearing from you. So I hope you'll come back tomorrow. We're talking about childhood and children. So I will see you later. Thank you very much.